Wait for it, wait for it. Welcome to the BerlinBrigade.com podcast with your host, David Guerra.
Welcome to episode 22 of the BerlinBrigade.com podcast. I am your host, David Guerra, former 3rd Platoon, Alpha Company, 6th Battalion, 502nd Infantry. I thank you for taking the time to join me today on this, the latest episode of the BerlinBrigade.com podcast. Hey, how about that FIFA 2010 World Cup? How about that Paul the Octopus correctly predicting the outcome of every Germany match in the World Cup, as well as the final? Talk about an international star, another one named Paul. Hey, I wonder if he can predict if and when the Astros will make it to the World Series again. Anyway, hey, how was your Independence Day? I hope you had a great time celebrating the birth of our nation. Also, a great big thanks to Jackie, Ockham, and the good people over at the McNair Museum for sharing with us on how the 4th of July was celebrated at McNair Barracks this year. Thanks again. And now, let's get this party started.
It's time for the special announcements!
I want to pass along a great big thank you to all the 3,600-plus registry entries. There are some great meetings taking place, and the only way that can continue to happen is by signing up if you haven't already done so. You sign up, you get yourself out there, somebody will find you, you find somebody out there on the registry page. Great connections and reconnections are happening all the time. As always, you can have your email address changed, and like I said in the last podcast, there have been a couple email addresses that have bounced back. So again, please make sure that your email address is up to date. And if by some reason you want to remove your registry, your email from the registry, all you need to do is resubmit the registry form. And in the comments section, please put either change of address if you're changing your email address, or please remove me from the registry, one or the other, and we'll get that taken care of. A reminder, the Daily Cold War Minute Cinchcast has been continuing since the 1st of June, and if you haven't checked it out, I invite you to do so at the www.cinchcast.com, cinchcast is all one word, .com/Berlin Brigade. Also, a widget is on the BerlinBrigade.com homepage. Click on it, it'll take you right to the page, you can listen to the Daily Cold War Minute update. Before I forget, or not forgetting, the Berlin U.S. Military Veterans Reunion is happening in Berlin this August, and I want to wish them a safe journey over to Berlin and a great time while in Berlin and a safe journey home. I also want to take a moment to pass along to everyone that's planning or is having a reunion in the future, near future, please drop me a note and at davidg@berlinbrigade.com to help get the word out. Also, I invite you, just as I invited the BUS MBA to have a representative come on the podcast, and we had Tom Hartney do that, and talk about the event. And so, again, y'all be careful out there going to Berlin and coming back. But again, if you've got an upcoming event, I want to hear from you. Everybody wants to hear from you. So you can start by sending me an email, davidg@berlinbrigade.com, and we can make it just as quick as we did with Tom, or we can turn it into a full-fledged episode and interview, and we can go from there. Lastly, I received an email from Christine Morast Hansen. Christine is the sister of J.R. Morast. J.R. was a Berlin Brigade soldier that was assigned to Bravo Company, 4th Battalion, 502nd Infantry. J.R. and I went to basic and AIT OSET in Fort Benning back in the summer of 1985. And then we went to Berlin together with a couple of other great guys, and we all ended up there, same unit. I'd never heard of that, but, you know, again, I'd never experienced that after that, that such a large number of guys going from one unit, from basic training straight into that unit, or any unit, but I digress. Anyway, she sends me this awesome letter, and we had talked in the past briefly, and then we reconnected again, and here, check this out. Unfortunately, JR, her brother, JR Morass, passed away while on BB Guard back in the spring of 1987. Those of you that were there, you might remember what happened. Christine sent me an email, and she was interested in making contact with anyone that knew her brother. Christine joined the BerlinBrigade.com fan page on Facebook, and almost instantly, I received an email back. She found a few of JR's friends right away from Bravo, 4th of the 502nd. Awesome. However, if you have not joined the fan page and you knew J.R. Morass, please drop us a note, and then we can forward that over to Christine, and y'all can connect there. She's been having a lot of fun. She's been sharing some great photos and bringing back some old memories of times of years gone by, and And it's been fun kind of reminiscing. And again, thank you for Christine for putting out the word. And everybody that's responded to Christine, thank you as well. What can I say? Great connections are happening. And if you haven't had a chance to join the fan page, do so. Let's see. Well, that pretty much brings us to an end of the announcements.
Take your seats because it's time for a special guest interview.
Before we start the episode 22 interview here at the BerlinBrigade.com podcast, I again want to thank our last guest, Robert Johnson, for spending time and sharing with us his experiences with the 298th Army Band and a little behind-the-scenes look at the Berlin Brigade Public Information Office. Thanks again, Robert. It was a lot of fun. In this episode, our guest is a very good friend, Thomas Heinrich Edward Hill, or T.H.E. Hill, author of Voices Under Berlin, A Tale of a Monterey Mary. If you have not picked up a copy of this book, I invite you to visit the BerlinBrigade.com homepage. On it, you'll see a link. It'll have the image of the book, and it takes you to our Sound and Vision page, and there you can get more information on how you can get your very own copy. In the meantime, open up a Berliner Kindle, unwrap that donor kebab, sit back, and enjoy the conversation. Joining us today is my good friend, Thomas Heinrich Edward Hill, otherwise known as T.H.E. Hill, author of Voices Under Berlin, The Tale of a Monterey Mary. Tom, thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Hey, anytime. And tell you what, I'm just going to go ahead and turn it over to you. Tell us about Voices Under Berlin and what that's all about, and then we're just going to just keep going from there.
Okay. Voices Under Berlin is a novel that's set in 1950s Berlin, and the background is the tunnel that the CIA dug from Rudow under the sector border to tap three telephone cables and listen to the Russians. And the novel is done in an interesting way technically, and one of the reviewers called it a novel that breaks all the molds. And it's a spy novel, of course. And the way that it breaks all the molds is there are two threads that run through it. One is the thread of the Americans who run in the tap for the CIA, and they're the guys who are listening to the Russian telephone calls. The other thread is the Russians who are talking on the telephone. But they're presented as transcripts without any comments of their telephone calls. So you get two different kinds of text. One is a normal spy story narration of the Americans who are doing the transcription. The other is you get to read the transcription that they do. And what ties the two threads together is that the Russians are running a honey trap. That's a sex for secrets operation against the guys who are doing the tap. And you hear the Russians talking about the honey trap, and they talk about Primrose, which is their cover name for the female part of the honey trap. And except you can't figure out who Primrose is until the last chapter of the book. And the people who are running this are not stupid, and the Russians who are running the op aren't stupid. The Russians think they can talk around it. The Americans don't think they can figure out who it is, but it takes them a long time to do it. And the only way that they do it is when one of the Russians makes a really big mistake. So it's set up differently than a normal spy novel, the way that the story progresses. It's gotten some really good reviews. It's got six book awards so far. Midwest Book Review says the authors, I'm quoting from their review, the authors combining a general gift for humor with a deft literary astuteness in telling a story that fully engages the reader quite literally from first page to last is one of the things that sets this novel apart. And that's pretty typical for some of the reviews that I've seen from people who were not in the business. When you look at things that are said by people who were actually in Berlin and worked in intelligence ops, you see people say lots of good memories. Here's one from somebody who was in Field Station Augsburg. Anyone who spent time in Germany in the military service or dealt with diverse individuals in difficult situations can identify with this story. The novel combines the politics of the military chain of command, the secretive intrigue of Cold War spying, and the quiet heroes who got the job done with their steady initiative and the heavy burden of angst. The novel is very entertaining with surprising moments of roll-your-eyes humor and tongue-in-cheek irony. And that's the other thing that's characteristic of the novel. Some reviewers have compared it to Catch-22, and some compare it to MASH, perhaps more to the books than to the television series.
I was just about to say that. It was definitely more to the movie than the actual TV episodes.
Yeah, I love Alan Alda and MASH, but the book was it. Well, it wasn't consciously written to do that. It was only after the fact that after people started reading the book and pointing that out, that I realized what had happened to them, to the story. And it's every time I try to explain this, people don't really believe it. Did you see the movie Alex and Emma? He's a writer, and he's doing he's writing a novel, and Emma is his stenographer. He's dictating to her, and he says that he's one of these authors who listens to the characters and lets them take him where the story should go. He doesn't plan beforehand. Well, I'm exactly the same kind of writer. I put one sentence down on screen and put the characters in a situation, and then all of a sudden I can hear their voices in my head, and they're telling me what to do. And every time I put the characters on page, they remembered how funny it was being at work, because this is more or less based on stories that I heard and things that I did myself when I was in Berlin. Changed around a little bit to, as they sometimes say, protect the guilty. And the characters, every time I put them on page, would decide to remember some strange, funny thing that happened when I was in the Army. And one of the readers wrote me a note and said he almost fell out of his chair. He was laughing so hard when he read the book. And some of the stories are really funny now, but they weren't so funny then. And one of the stories, I talk about a lieutenant who has a sidearm with real bullets in it because he's the courier for classified information. And he pulls out the weapon and he's threatening people with it. Well, when I was the driver for this lieutenant with a loaded sidearm who was waving it around in the car, I was sure that he was about to shoot me. It makes a funnier story when you tell it 30 years after the day, and you can relax a little bit and see the humor in it.
Yeah, definitely. I agree. I understand. It's this story, and I'm kind of taking you out of your thing here, but just kind of as a point of reference, I think we all share something like that. I know that prior to me joining the military, the funniest military movie I ever saw was Stripes. Then after basic training and a couple of months into my military career, that was the most serious movie I have ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just one of those things. It seems so preposterous, but then you're on the ground and it's the reality.
Yeah.
And it's funny to them, but once you're in it, it's a whole different perspective.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes I get comments from people who had never been in the military. You get that more these days now that the draft has ended, and they don't believe that any of the things that I describe in the book were possible. And I assure you that they were all based to some degree or other on things that actually happened to people or to me. And Catch-22, I've had younger people talk to me about Catch-22 and say, "Oh, that can't be real. He made that all up." No, I've been in the military, and Catch-22 and MASH were real. Those kind of things actually did happen, and I've talked to people who've been there and done that. Remember in the book that Radar O'Reilly is mailing a Jeep out through the APO one piece at a time? I knew a guy who was trying to do that. I don't remember if he ever got the whole thing out or not. I left before he did. But there's an interesting audience for this book. It's both for people who were in the military, and from them I get a different set of reactions than I get from people who were never in the military. So it's been fun doing the project, and I really enjoyed it. It was one of these things that had been sitting in the back of my mind for a long time, and I wanted to record what it was like to fight the secret Cold War. But there are all kinds of restrictions on people who actually fought the secret Cold War. You have to submit your book to be approved and this kind of stuff. So I couldn't say that this is the way it was when I was in the Army. I had to say this is the way it was in 1950. And when I actually found a guy who worked the tunnel in 1950, he read the book and said, "It's not really my Berlin, but it's damn close." And there was another comment that I like from somebody who's in Afghanistan right now doing the same kind of thing. And he said, "Anybody who's involved in this business should read the book because nothing has changed. As I type this, the same kind of things are happening today." And it gives you a sense of continuity, and it lets you know that, it was fun, and it was one of the most important experiences in my life. And like the guy said, things haven't changed a lot. It was good to hear that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. And as much as time changes and progresses, you know, it just also lets you know that things still remain the same. That's interesting. That's interesting to hear. So there's hope. There's hope. There's hope, or heaven help us. One or the other. Yeah. But no, I understand. And yeah, definitely it is something that if you're a Cold War history buff, this is one for you, without a doubt. I've got my copy, and it's awesome. This book is awesome. And if you're there, even though I was in Berlin in the 80s, it's still very much, again, a feel of the city, a feel of the time, a feel of the place. It hasn't changed that much, even in that, 20, 30 years that you're covering there from the book to when I was there. And then now to hear this, that now, you know, 50 years later, it's still kind of, things are still running the same as far as the story goes and the mood in the story and what's going on within the story and what's happening in the real world on the ground right now. Very interesting to hear.
Yeah, I did a lot of historical research to make the book sound like it should have for the 1950s. The book is illustrated. I got pictures of military script, which is military monopoly money. There used to be dollar script, but when I was there in the 70s, the only script that there was were BAFs, which were the things that you had to use to pay in the British PX. We had full access to the British PX. In my day, just like you did. Did you have to pay in BAFs, or did you pay in British pounds?
No, I recall going maybe once or twice, and I want to say I paid in marks.
In marks? Oh.
Yes.
Oh, I guess they did make some changes. But that was the kind of stuff that I did. I have a collection of Welcome to Berlin booklets from the 1950s. That I used as the basis of what it was like to live in Berlin and the military in the 1950s. The PX complex at Truman Plaza only opened in 1953. Before that, it was at Uncle Tom's Hütte. There are pictures of that in my collection of books. And as I was finishing up Voices, I started looking to see if any of the libraries in the country, like the Library of Congress, any university libraries, had copies of these booklets that I've got. And I discovered that nobody had any. So I reproduced the entire set in a companion volume to voices. It's called Berlin and Early Cold War Army Booklets. And that's interesting if you really want to feel what it was like at the same time that they were working the tunnel. Because the first booklet that I have is 1950. And then it's the same. It's a tour of Berlin, and it's the same tour every time. But each time the book was republished, the text would change a little bit. And it goes from the first book where Hitler and the filthy Nazis are the enemy and we have to bring justice to Germany, to the very end in 1958 when the Germans are our friends and the Russians are our enemies. And you can see the change in the text, and the text is marked up so that you can see which parts of each succeeding version of the book has changed to give you a feeling for exactly what it was like during that time. That was before the wall went up, when things were getting tight between the airlift and the wall. The airlift, the last time we were in Berlin, we went out to Wannsee and we took the boat that goes all the way across the Wannsee as part of the city bus lines. And we sat down at a table inside, and we were looking for Teufelsberg, which was where I used to work. And as Teufelsberg came into view, there was an old German couple sitting on the other side of the table from us. And the gentleman started to say, pointed to Teufelsberg and told his wife, "Look, that's where the Americans used to work." And I couldn't resist. I replied to him in German. I said, "I'm one of the Americans who used to work there." And the man spent the rest of the boat ride telling me how thankful he was for the Americans and everything they did in Berlin. And he was one of the people who was offloading planes during the airlift. And he said, "Our son, who was born the year of the airlift, and we only survived based on the things that came in on those planes that the Americans flew." And he apologized that the younger generation of Germans didn't appreciate all the things that we'd done for them anymore. I was really touched by this. And it's the kind of thing that it helps if you speak German, because the guy didn't speak any English. But I still can't get over this story and the amount of gratitude that this gentleman and his wife demonstrated for us compared to some of the things that I'd run into earlier on this trip, talking to younger Germans who were disdainful of the fact that I have an accent when I speak German and just treated me like I was some kind of horrible American tourist. But compared to them, he made me feel really good, and it was one of the highlights of the trip.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's certainly times have changed there in Berlin. Yeah. You know what? Speaking of the airlift, today is Friday, June 25th, and we're recording this this conversation, this interview here with Tom T.H.E. Hill, author of Voices Under Berlin, Tale of a Monterey Mary. And, you know, flashback 1948, on this day, General Lucius Clay gave the word for Operation Vittles to launch. The day before, June 24th, 1948, the Soviets blockaded Berlin. So, wow, it's kind of interesting that we're speaking about this as we're celebrating, or kind of not necessarily celebrating, but remembering this time in history. Very interesting that it all just kind of all fell together today. That's pretty wild.
Yeah.
You know what? And you also have a website. I'm sorry. Go ahead, sir. Go ahead.
It's also rather disappointing that sometimes I speak with Americans. I'm at a university, and I talked to somebody who is a well-educated lady. She's very well-read. And I said, "The Berlin airlift began today." She said, "The what?" She didn't know anything about the Berlin airlift, and it was really kind of strange. you were about to say something about the website. The website,
oh, yes, sir. Go ahead.
For the novel is Voices Under Berlin, all one word, .com. And you can read about the book. There's a sample chapter online. You can read summaries or reviews. You can find out where to order a copy. probably Amazon is probably the best place to look. Website also has the Americans in Berlin commemorative stamps page, which is voicesunderberlin.com/stamps1.html. And those are a series of Cinderella stamps that commemorate the almost 50 years that Americans were stationed in Berlin.
Yep, I certainly know those stamps very well, sir. I want to thank you. It definitely was an honor to be in Berlin on November 9th of last year, 2009, and to present those to the Allied Museum. I didn't get a chance to properly, and I don't think I ever will be able to properly thank you for the opportunity, but it certainly was a wonderful time getting everything to come together like that. That was awesome. And it was
my pleasure to be able to let you do it. Actually, I was very pleased that you could do it. I had tried to arrange to go myself, but couldn't. And then when you were going to be there at the same time, thank you very much for all your effort and going to make a speech and present them to the Allied Museum here in the old Outpost Theater.
Oh, yeah, it was a wonderful time. Great reception. I'm sorry you didn't get the personal tour. That was awesome. I got to see a little behind scenes action and stuff that was going on there at the museum, all the cool stuff. Mm-hmm. And it was fantastic. It was one of those once in a lifetime things. Folks, if you ever get a chance to get back to Berlin, and for those of you that are going in August, be sure you stop by the outpost. I know you're going to. Part of the group is going there, the Berlin U.S. Military Veterans Association. That group is going back here this August. Check it out. Ask for the tour. Get the whole thing behind the scenes. And you know what? You're actually going to get to see a piece of the tunnel that Tom is referring to in his book, Voices Under Berlin. It's actually there. You'll see a small section there. And at the far end, it looks like it goes even further. But you'll need to see it to see what I'm talking about. That was awesome. And did you get a chance to go there and see that?
Yes, I did get a chance to go there, and it was really a lot of fun to stand at the entrance to the tunnel and look down and imagine what it was like for the people who actually worked the tunnel. There are a lot of stories that I got from the official history, things that happened, like the dead man in the tunnel. Do you remember that story?
Yes.
People who were digging the tunnel bought a skeleton on Potsdamer Platz on the black market and then threw it in the dirt that they were digging up at the tunnel face and sent it back to the end to scare everybody. It was a lot of fun to go to the museum and see the tunnel segment that's there. It made it feel even more real for me, all the things that go on in the novel.
Oh, yeah, certainly. And you know, first being there, experiencing that, seeing this, and seeing what was going on, and getting the briefing on where the tunnel was, how it was laid out. And then, you know, you crack open the book, and it's like, okay, yeah, here it is. And this is what they're talking about. So, again, you get to put, for those that get the chance to go to the museum and see it, they'll read the book or have already read the book, you'll get to make that association, and it becomes even more real. So that is awesome. That was a lot of fun.
Well, and for people who can't quite make it to Berlin to see it, there are links to the museum website and the pictures that they have of the tunnel segment on the novel's website as well. It's under Berlin links. So if you can't make it yourself, you can take the virtual tour.
Which is, you know, that's a good thing. It is true. It is definitely true. And you get to see it, but it's the real thing. What you're looking at is a photo of the real thing. And it's not a facsimile or a computer generated. It's the actual, it's what was there. So that makes it even, okay, you know, not as good. But again, it's my bias. I'm sorry. it comes out. But again, if you can make it, go for it. Be sure you do it. Tell you what, let's just keep pressing on. You've got something else in the works, and I know this because, well, we chatted before, but My question to you earlier, and I'm going to ask you again, and please give me the answer because you gave me an awesome answer. And the question is your next work, you've got a project underway, and what was the inspiration or when did you decide, you know what, I got to do this?
Okay. When I was sending Voices Under Berlin around to agents, one of the agents said, you know, this would sell a lot better if it had more sex and violence in it. But I didn't want to write a book full of sex and violence because that wasn't the way I experienced Berlin. The most violence there was when you walked into a door, and I mean walked into a door and not got hit in the eye. So I didn't do that for this novel, but I said, well, let me see if I can do that for another novel. And the result is The Day Before the Berlin Wall, Could We Have Stopped It? And it's based on a legend that was being told when I was in Berlin in the 70s that we knew that the wall was going to be built. And we were told by the same source that if we took aggressive action, that the German engineers would pull back and we could stop the construction of the wall. So I took that idea and said, let me see if I can write a novel with sex and violence in it to this tune. And what I did was I have a young American sergeant who's got this piece of information, and he's in East Berlin, and he needs to get back to report it. And the Stasi has framed him for a murder, and they've asked for the Polizei to cooperate with them to capture him. So now he's got to get back with his information and convince people that it's real. But the funny thing was, I'm one of these authors who starts a page and then listens to the characters talk in his head. They're like people you know. When you work on a novel long enough, you feel like you actually know the people who are participating in your novel. And I'd start them out, and I'd have this setup that's going to be full of sex and violence. And three sentences later, the characters had taken that away and there was no sex and there was no violence. Well, there was a little sex. And they changed it. And if you've ever seen the movie Alex and Emma, he's an author and she's his stenographer. And he tells exactly the same kind of story. And I was so surprised when I watched this movie and heard him explain that, because that's exactly the way that I write. I listen to the people who are the characters in my novel, and they tell me what to put down on the page. And it takes a while to get to that point, but once you get to that point, you can make a lot of progress, and the story usually turns out a lot better that way. It's the same thing that happened when I was writing Voices. I would start out a page, and then the characters will all of a sudden remind me of something funny that had happened in it. And that was a good thing, too, because of all the great reactions that I've had to Voices from that. The Day Before the Berlin Wall is due for release on 9 November of this year, which is the 21st anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall. I couldn't get it ready for the 13th of August, which is the anniversary of the construction of the wall. One of the interesting things about the novel, this one has two endings, and as you get to the point for the last chapter, reader gets to choose which one he or she wants. Do you want the ending that's historically correct and ends with the construction of the wall, or do you want the other ending where they don't build the wall? I think perhaps I was influenced by the new mode of DVDs where some movies come out and have alternate endings. It's also interesting the way it's set up now to read both endings because they play off against one against the other, and you get to better understand exactly what is happening in the entire story and why we didn't stop the wall.
Wow, sounds like it's going to be a lot of fun. Very interesting to read too. And go ahead. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm sending around to test readers right now, and the initial reactions have been pretty positive.
Good, good. That's a good thing. So we look forward to that, definitely. Again, you're shooting for 9 November of this year.
That's right.
That should be a great read. Take us right into the holiday season. Something a little spy-ish, a little Berlin-ish, a little bit of everything. Action and, of course, sex and violence. And, you know, that always sells. No one's going to lie to you. I have to agree. You know, just a little, not too much. But again, something to take us into the holiday. Should be a great holiday read.
I would hope so. Yeah.
Okay, so great. So we should be on the lookout for that. And again, so it's just going to be just a continuation of the we'll be able to find this under the Voices Under Berlin website, or is it going to have its own website? Or
It'll eventually get its own website, but right now it's under voicesunderberlin.com/daybefore.html. You can read the dedication and the basic blurb about the book. There'll be a sample there shortly, as soon as the sample, probably the first chapter is frozen. As long as it's still being edited, I'm not going to put it up.
Gotcha. And speaking of the dedication, I got a chance to read that. That is truly an awesome dedication.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
I'll just read you part of the dedication.
Sir, by all means, please, sir.
This book is dedicated to the countless men and women of Berlin Command and Berlin Brigade who stood resolutely shoulder to shoulder with the West Berliners during the Cold War, ensuring that the island of freedom known as West Berlin remained free. In June 1963, from a platform erected on the steps of Rathaus Schöneberg in Berlin, John F. Kennedy made his world-famous statement that is often shortened in quotation to, "Ich bin ein Berliner," I'm a Berliner. What Kennedy actually said was, "Today in the world of freedom, the proudest boast is, Ich bin ein Berliner." The men and women of Berlin Command and Berlin Brigade felt this same sense of pride in being Berliners, perhaps even more strongly than Kennedy, because they actually lived in Berlin, sharing the fate of those whom it was their duty to defend. They knew the dangers of brinksmanship better than most, because they would have been the first casualties if the post-war peace in Europe failed. Yet for almost 45 years, they never flinched. They can proudly say that they held their outpost of freedom until relieved. I am an old Berliner, and I believe that. And for everybody who served in Berlin and helped defend freedom, my thanks for your service to your country.
Oh, yes, definitely. I read the dedication, and I know you had asked me earlier about it, and I wanted to save it for now. It's like powerful words. All of them are true. Not one, like you said, it doesn't flinch. It's just right there. There you go. Mm-hmm. It doesn't fail us. It's exactly what happened. We became part of them. They became part of us. We all lived, breathed, grew, and if worse came to worse, we all would have died together. But we
That's
were together.
Right.
We were all.
In Voices Under Berlin, I have this story about Kevin, who's the Russian transcriber, and he goes around blithely telling everybody that the Russian word troop, which sounds exactly like the American word troop, which is what we all were, means dead body. And that's what we'd all have been if the war had started. Where I worked up at Teufelsberg, we were sighted in by Russian artillery, which was less than 20 clicks away. We'd have had under 30 seconds from the time of the initiation of hostilities till we were all dead. But everybody went to work every day, and everybody worked real hard.
Exactly. The mission was the city, and we were the city.
That's right. And the thing that I like about the Allied Museum is the blurb that they have at the opening page that talks about the American troops who came to Berlin in 1945, as conquerors. And when we left in 1994, we left as friends. I made a lot of good friends in Berlin, and that's the truth. And the man on the boat who thanked us is the best example of that I can bring to mind right now. We were there for them when they needed us.
Oh, yeah, certainly, certainly. And, I mean, even now, I PCS'd out of there in 87, and to this day I'm still making friends in Berlin. And it just goes to show how much part of all of that was and how much we were all part of that and all together. So, yeah, I mean, when I went back in November, it was an awesome time. And, again, it was almost like as if we hadn't left, but we did. But, yeah. You know, it was the and unfortunately, yes, it was the older ones that were more receptive to what was going on and what everything meant and who was there and what, mm-hmm. who they were talking to. The younger ones just saw it more as an opportunity to, you know, well, we'll never know what that city was like before the wall. But, you know what, we're here now. This is our time. And you can see that. And it was kind of almost like a passing of the torch, per se, from yeah. the old to the new. And deep down, though, the city's still the same. And that
oh, yeah, you can feel the city is the same when you walk around. But to underscore your point about the younger Berliners, I read a statistic in a German newspaper. It said they went to high schools and they did a poll. And one of the questions is, who is Walter Ulbricht? Ulbricht was, of course, the head of the SED, the Socialist Einheitspartei, the Communist Party. And some incredible percentage of the students, over 30%, thought that Ulbricht was a leader of the opposition in East Germany. They're forgetting the lessons of history, and unfortunately, people who forget their history are doomed to repeat it.
Yeah, and that definitely is the sad part. Yeah, and it's not just there; it's over here too. We talk about. Oh, yeah. We talk about the fall of the wall, and it's like, what's that? What wall? What are we talking about? You mentioned the Berlin Wall and the division of the cities, and it's unfortunately, you know, not to get too political because I really don't want to, but it gets the stigma of the border wall with the United States and Mexico. And those are two different walls. It's two different things, two different worlds. Mm-hmm. But the only reference is because the media does that. It'll reference the Berlin Wall is the border wall is just like the Berlin Wall, and that's not what it is. It's two different things, and it's like sometimes you feel like standing on top of that wall and just shouting, "I've been to Berlin. I know what the wall is. This is not the wall. This is something totally different."
No, the wall in Berlin separated families, people who wanted to be together and couldn't be together anymore. They walled up houses that fronted on the border. People jumped out of the third floor windows of some of those houses on Bernauer Straße and were killed. There were 167 people who were killed trying to cross the wall into West Berlin. It's even more personal to me because I knew people who worked in the mission. And the last casualty of the Cold War was a classmate of mine. Nick Nicholson was shot by a Russian sentry when he was on tour with USMLM. And they wouldn't allow him, his driver, to run to him and give him first aid, and he bled to death. I was one of the people who was prepared to go get in a tank and wait till the Russian mission in Frankfurt deployed its next car and run over it. They wouldn't let us do that, but there were plenty of people in line behind me who would have done it as well. It's you have investment in Berlin. Berlin is still a great part of my life, even though my tour ended in 1977. I sometimes tell people that was where I grew up, when I stopped being a kid and became actually an intelligent human being.
Yeah, I think we share that across the board with many others that were there in Berlin with us, before us, after us, and with us there. I say the exact same thing to people too. They ask me, you know, what's the one thing you loved about your military career? Well, you know, it was Berlin, and again, in Berlin, that's where I grew up.
Yeah.
Because everything was so real. It wasn't, you know, fuzzy. It wasn't a gray area. It was black and white. It was right there.
Yeah.
You saw the line. This is it. Good guys, bad guys. Mm-hmm. And on the other side of the wall, they saw us as the bad guys. But that's besides the point. The point is that this was real. It didn't get any realer than this.
No.
I mean, where else would you go on guard duty locked and loaded? Or where else would you do that? Or, I'm sorry, loaded and locked. I've been watching too many war movies lately or something. But, again, you know, in the States, you come back to the States, you go do something, and it's a whole different mindset.
Yeah.
But there in Berlin, it was – you didn't mess around. I mean, yeah, you had your fun because you had to.
Yeah.
Had to have it. And anybody you talk to, there's always that story about that one guy, or there's always a story about the driver doing this, or there was a story about some lieutenant doing that. Doesn't matter. It had to. It was just – that's how we cope with it.
Yeah,
when
you're living in an insane asylum, the only way you can keep your sanity is to laugh at yourself and do something equally as insane. So otherwise, you actually will go crazy.
Exactly. Okay, Tom. Well, listen, tell you what. I was looking here at the website, and you made some mention to it earlier about winning some awards. Want to share about the last one I know about, and that was last Veterans Day, and you mentioned there might be another, I think there was another one after that, so if you want to go ahead and tell us about the awards and all of that and how that all came to be.
Book's gotten 6 awards so far. You mentioned the one specifically in Branson on Veterans Day. That was a really good experience. They had a whole bunch of military writers who got awards. They brought you up on stage, you got a medal, and then you were essentially the guest of the city of Branson for a week. And every place you went, people would see your button that said you were a veteran, and they'd all thank you for your service to your country. I had never felt so appreciated in my life. I'm from the Vietnam era, and I have been spit on in public in my uniform, and this was a huge change from that, and I very much appreciated it. And it's a contest that's open only to people who write on military topics and who have actually served in the military themselves. Or the lady was sitting next to me in the auditorium as we're getting ready to go up and get our awards, was mother of a soldier who had died in Iraq. And she wrote his biography based on his letters that he'd sent her from Iraq. And that was, I think that award was well deserved. She had done a very good job with it. And she had paid a very high price for that award herself.
Wow, interesting. And so that was the entire week before and after Veterans Day, correct?
That's right. Branson has, they bill it as the biggest Veterans Day celebration in the United States. They have flags every place that you can go in town. They have meetings and presentations for veterans. Everything is set up to wish you a good time. You can go to all the shows in Branson. Branson is the live entertainment capital of the world. And every place you went, I didn't have to pay for myself. I just had to pay to get my wife in because I was a veteran and an award winner. Like I said, it made me feel very welcome, very proud to have been in the military.
Wow, pretty sweet deal. Should be something to... I need to check out there in Branson. This is one of these Veterans Day soon. And so you've won another one since then, correct?
Since then, I've won the National Independent Excellence Award. And that's a special award for small presses, independent presses, and people from all over the country. It's a national award. You compete in specific genre categories, and they put me in the miscellaneous category because I didn't fit in any of the standard marketing categories for books. The way that Voices is written, it really does justify what that one reviewer said. a spy novel that breaks all the molds. So they couldn't find any place else to put put voices, and they made it put it in the category miscellaneous. I thought that was really interesting because it is so unique. It's not like a lot of books that you read.
Oops, sorry about that. I couldn't get back to the unmute button as fast as possible. So you got 6 for this book, and I see also on the website that it's in its 4th edition now?
Yep, it's in its 4th edition. That means that it's been well received, and I'm pleased to see that it's going so well.
Wow, definitely a big kudos. I mean, not a lot of books go make it past their first edition. That is pretty cool.
Yeah, I was real pleased with the response that it's gotten so far, and I hope it'll keep up. I'd like to see it go into the 5th edition.
Yeah, that'd be pretty neat. Yeah, recently on our Facebook fan page, I mentioned that I ran across an interview with a newspaper in San Francisco, if I'm correct. And it posted that up there, and that was pretty interesting. People got the chance to read that interview. Mm-hmm. This was really cool. So, you know, the word's still out there. The awards obviously help, and that's a good thing. So, yeah, but then again, they don't just hand out awards for writing a book. I mean, you've got to write something pretty good.
Yep. There's a lot of competition out there, and I'm very pleased to have gotten this much recognition for a book that's so unusual.
Well, then that makes us eager to look forward to the next one. So that's a good thing. You know what? Let's go ahead and start wrapping this up if you're okay with that.
Okay.
And, here on BerlinBrigade.com podcast, there's always the standard questions that everybody gets asked. It doesn't matter who you are, what rank you were or still are, or what you did when you were in Berlin, or if you're still in Berlin. It doesn't matter. You get asked the same questions. Question number one, what's like the one thing you miss about the city?
I live in a college town now, and it's open late at night for the students. But what I miss the most about Berlin is that I used to work Trick, and I could get off at 12 o'clock and I could go out and the city would still be open. That's not happening here. Not that I stay up that late this much anymore, but Berlin was alive 24 hours a day. And there was so much to see and so much to do. It's not the same feel here as I had in Berlin. I still remember that very fondly.
Okay, well, that's – there you go. Yeah, that's pretty much the thing. It's because it is such a huge city, an international city, and it wasn't just us that were there, and it wasn't just the Germans. But, you know, it's all walks of life. Everybody came to that city, whether the wall was up or not, even
right
now. So, again, it had a life all its own, and it was constantly on the go. And mm-hmm. still is today, and that's never going to go away. But then again, it's just like New York or Paris or London or any
right
other major city in the world. It's just going to keep moving. It doesn't sleep. And that's a good thing. Okay, well, now let's move on to the question I ask everybody. Where were you when, where was THE Hill when the wall came down?
I was in Vienna. I was in a hotel. I was assigned to the embassy in Prague and would come out to have the car serviced. And I got up and had the TV on to watch the morning news, and I saw the wall fall. And I couldn't believe my eyes and ears. I had thought that the wall would be there forever. And then it collapsed. I got to watch the people saying, "Wir sind das Volk." We are the people. That was what they chanted to the border guards. And because the German state had always been built on the concept of this is the people's state. And it was that way in all the newspapers. And then the guards just didn't know what to do. They'd open the gates and the wall had collapsed. They weren't prepared to fire. And I was out. I'd been in Prague for the Velvet Revolution, and I had been on the street with an office mate who had who had been there, and we were going out to lunch, and we walked onto Wenceslas Square, and it was full from one end to the other. There was over 500,000 people there, and we decided quickly we weren't going to go to lunch. We split up. I said, you go this way, and I'll go that way, and if the cops wrap you up or wrap me up, go back and report this. And Havel and Dubček were standing on a balcony overlooking the square, and they raised their hands in victory, and they could have said anything they wanted at that minute. That was the moment that I realized that the communist state had collapsed in Czechoslovakia. They never recovered after that, because like the East Germans, the Czechs weren't prepared to use force to suppress the revolution. And that would have been the only thing that they could have done to regain control. That had to bring back the Russian tanks. They weren't ready to do that, and the East Germans weren't ready to do that. The Russians at that point weren't prepared for the things that they'd have had to do to restore control. And that was so by the time I got to Vienna to have my car serviced, I saw the wall fall on TV. I sort of realized myself that they'd lost it everywhere, and they weren't ever going to come back.
Wow, yeah, it must have been an awesome time to be in well, Eastern Europe at that time. You got to see it all kind of build up to that. As my understanding, people were basically moving through Austria and cutting across to get in, or coming in from Hungary and cutting across through Austria and coming in that way to kind of circumvent those gates that were still closed at the time prior to.
I have a story about that too. When the East Germans discovered that they could get out by breaking into West German embassies and claiming asylum. The West German embassy was about half a block up the street from ours. And I went into work one day, and when I came out, the street was full of East Germans. I couldn't get home. I couldn't move my car. I couldn't get out to public transportation to get home, because the West German embassy was full to overflowing, and the Czechs had agreed that they would consider the street in front of the embassy territory. It was amazing. That was just another indication that everything was collapsing in the East at that time.
Wow. So everything was just slowly unraveling.
Yeah.
Again, you know, to be stateside, it was one thing, because, again, everything was filtered. To be there, I definitely, you know, you see it day to day, and, yeah, you could really see where things were going.
Yeah.
Wow.
When I finally got my car out, there was a note in the windshield wiper, and a handful of East German coins on the hood, and it said, "Thank you for the use of your car as a place to sleep." That was a very interesting episode. They eventually put all the East Germans on buses and drove them out to West Germany. Like I said, that was just another sign that they couldn't control the situation anymore.
Wow. Wow. That's very, to say the least, very interesting. Wow. But again, you know, it's the times and that's the situation, and they did what they had to do. Pretty interesting.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, listen, let's go ahead and start wrapping this up, sir. As always, I give the floor to everybody. Just last parting shots, comments, anything we should be on the lookout for in your new book, any teaser or anything like that you want to throw out. You've thrown out enough, but, I mean, if you just want to add a little something more to kind of close out the interview, that'd be kind of nice. Strictly, the floor is up to you. The floor is yours, sir.
Well, after this book, there's another book planned, and it's set where else? In Berlin. And the idea for the book at the moment is that it's going to be a GI who goes back to Berlin in the present day and meets his old girlfriend. And I'll discuss all the changes in Berlin now and compare them to what it was like when I was there. I'm hoping to get working on that one probably beginning of next year.
Wow. The system, the application that we use actually cut off Tom here, so he didn't get a chance to, well, he did finish what he said, but it's going to be cut off. And obviously the system wants you to stay tuned or wait for the next book to come out and read what's going on there. But I thank you for sharing that little information there on a preview of things to come. So that's really cool.
You're quite welcome.
Yeah. Okay, everyone. Well, listen, we've been talking here today with Thomas Heinrich Edward Hill, otherwise known as T.H.E. Hill, author of Voices Under Berlin, and a new book coming out real soon. But for now, we want to thank him for his time, taking his time here on June 25th. It's a Friday night. We had a lot of things happen tonight, but hey, a lot of fun too. So that was always awesome to talk to him. Sir, again, I want to thank you for everything you've done for me, for veterans, for Berlin, for everybody. It's awesome, awesome stuff. And thank you for your time, most of all.
And thank you for inviting me, and thank everybody who listens for their service.
Oh, every day, definitely, definitely. And we thank you also for your service too, sir. Well, listen, there's always a standing invitation. If you want to give us an update on how the book is going, I really want you to come back on and talk to us and let us know if things are still on track for November 9th of this year. That's awesome. I know life happens because life has a way of doing its own thing. So we'll kind of keep that as the target date, and definitely it's a reason for a good date. But again, if anything happens, definitely let us know because I'm interested. I can't wait. I can't wait to get a hold of that. And like I said, it should be a great holiday read. I like to hunker down for the holidays, get one book, and I just devote, you know, family time. But I also try to minimize all the other outside distractions, keep things close. And when I do find myself with some free time, a good book is always a way to go. So I look forward to this one.
Okay.
Well, listen, thanks a lot.
I'll keep in touch then.
Thank you very much, sir. Again, everybody, we've been talking to Thomas Heinrich Edward Hill, otherwise known as T.H.E. Hill. Thanks for everything, and we will talk to you later.
Thanks to you, and good night.
Good night.
A great big Berlin Brigade thank you to T.H.E. Hill for joining us today, and that interview was a lot of fun. So again, thank you, sir. Folks, the time has come to start wrapping up episode 22 of the BerlinBrigade.com podcast. Remember, you can always send us comments, concerns, questions, and show ideas to davidg@BerlinBrigade.com. Or you can stay up to date with the latest at BerlinBrigade.com by following us on Twitter at www.twitter.com/BerlinBrigade, all one word. Or you can join the BerlinBrigade.com on our MySpace page. And you could also do what over 800 of our fellow Berlin Brigade members and supporters have done, and that is to join us on the BerlinBrigade.com fan page on Facebook. And you can do that by following the links on the BerlinBrigade.com homepage. All of us invite you to come and join all the great conversations that are happening there. It is a great conversation. We have over, like I said, we have over 800 members. And if you're looking for a reason to join Facebook, now continues to be a great time to sign up and join our conversation. Listen, until next time, I am your host, Dave Guerra, and this has been the 22nd episode of the BerlinBrigade.com podcast. I thank you for listening. Stay safe. Oh, we're still looking for the key to the clock tower, so if you've got it, let us know. And until next time, Auf Wiedersehen.
Sergeant Major, dismiss the brigade! The BerlinBrigade.com podcast is a Dave Guerra production. Thank you.